On Sunday, December 1st at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature Dr. Farrah Jasmine Griffin, a William B. Ransford Professor of English Comparative Studies at Columbia University. Dr. Griffin is the author of Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists and Progressive Politics During World War II, where the focus is on novelist Anne Petrie, dancer-choreographer Pearl Primus, and pianist, composer, and arranger Mary Lou Williams. That's Sunday, December 1st at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. You know, it's amazing. I set stuff up, and I press the button, and it doesn't go. And that's just cuckoo. Oh, cancel. Stop that. Play. Now.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. David Kenny is a king. I'm just telling you, he's a king. And he'll be back next Sunday with Everything Old is New Again. What we have coming up next is Farrah Jasmine Griffin, Dr. Farrah Jasmine Griffin. And we will be talking about her book, Harlem Nocturne. You'll hear exactly what we're talking about. But then you can hear lots and lots of music from Mary Lou Williams. So stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for... oh, all sorts of good conversation. So, like I said, this is Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. And we're just going to have a good time. Doing what? What are we going to do here? We're going to enjoy some... What's that?
I want some sugar. In my bowl.
My name is Joyce Jones, and I'm here with
Farah Jasmine Griffin.
Dr. Farah Jasmine Griffin is a professor of English, comparative literature, and African American studies at Columbia University, and she's the author of, we had you on in December with Celine Washington for Clawing at the Limits of Cool, and you're also the author of If You Can't Be Free, Be a Mystery, the book about Billie Holiday, which we discussed. It was either this year or last year. And we're discussing today your latest book, Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists of Progressive Politics During World War II. First off, hello, Farah.
Hi there, Joyce. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's always great to see you. Now, how did you decide on these women during this period in the location that you're focusing on?
I had been doing some research on a couple of smaller projects. One was a set of liner notes that I wrote for a reissue of a Lena Horne CD. It's the second time that Lena Horne records Stormy Weather on that CD. It was in 57, I think. And I was researching her career and, you know, sort of discovering things about her emergence in the 1940s when she becomes a star. And I fell in love with the period, just the 1940s, based on all the research that I did on Lena Horne. And then I was also working on some research for a project that George Wolfe produced called Harlem Song that was up at the Apollo for a little while. For that, I had done some research on Harlem in the 1940s. So these separate projects really introduced me to Harlem during this period, and I got really interested and really excited about it.
Now, the women that you feature within this book, Harlem Nocturne, who are they and why did you choose them?
Certainly. So there are three women. There's Pearl Primus, who's a dancer and a choreographer, and she's best known for her contribution to African dance, but I focus on her very early part of her career. The novelist Anne Petrie, who wrote the novel The Street, among other books and stories, and the composer and pianist and arranger Mary Lou Williams. So they're the three women. I chose them because all of them had acquired a degree of celebrity and fame for their work in the 1940s, and then later on, audiences seem to know less and less about them. So I thought this would be an opportunity to reintroduce them and to figure out why they were so well known in the 1940s and why they became less well known as time went on.
And you also focus on their activity. Well, the subtitle is Women Artists of Progressive Politics During World War II.
So all three of them were very politically engaged during that period. I mean, their level of political involvement changes over time. But during the 1940s, and I think we often don't think about a kind of social movement of the 40s. We think about the 60s or even maybe the 1950s. But much of what we attribute to, like the Montgomery bus boycott, the sit-ins, much of that was starting to happen in the 1940s. So there was a social movement already kind of bubbling about. And these three women artists were very politically engaged and also use their artwork as either a way to communicate those politics or to support those politics.
And I notice that also during World War II, I'm guessing that the treatment that the soldiers had gotten when they returned more or less encouraged more political engagement.
Right. I would say that World War II was complex. It did a lot of things. On the one hand, there was a level and a degree of patriotism because it was a good war. It was a war against Nazism, which I think for many black people was a war against white supremacy. And so it was a war that ostensibly many black people could support. And at the same time, you know, while they were willing to support it, they also used that as an opportunity to point up the contradictions of fighting a war for democracy, fighting a war against white supremacy, when they still lived in a country that was Jim Crow and segregated, and in a country where black people were second-class citizens. And so they saw themselves as fighting on both fronts, abroad and at home. And at the same time, I think you're absolutely right, it wasn't even the treatment of the black soldiers after they got home. It was the treatment of the black soldiers during that period. They were in a segregated military. Often they would be sent to the Jim Crow South for basic training, where they would be subjected to racist treatment, where they would be subjected to mob violence while still in their uniforms. So the black soldier comes to represent something very important to this generation, and almost all of the women talk about the importance of the black soldier in supporting him as he fights for democracy for a country that he doesn't even have a full practice of democracy in.
Over there, World War II. Dear fellow Americans, I write this letter hoping times will be better when this war is through. I'm a tan-skinned Yank driving a tank. I ask, will V-Day be me day too? I wear a U.S. uniform. I've done the enemy much harm. I've driven back the Germans and the Japs from Burma to the Rhine on every battle line. I've dropped defeat into the fascist laps. I am a Negro American out to defend my land, Army, Navy, Air Corps. I am there. I take the munitions through. I fight or stevedore too. I face death the same as you do, everywhere. So this is what I want to know. When we see victory's glow, will you still let old Jim Crow hold me back? When all those foreign folks who've waited, Italians, Chinese, Danes, are liberated, will I still be ill-fated because I'm black? Here in my own, my native land, will the Jim Crow law still stand? Will Dixie lynch me still when I return? Or will you, comrades in arms, from the factories and farms, have learned what this war was fought for us to learn? You can't say I didn't fight to smash the fascist might. You can't say I wasn't with you in each battle, as a soldier and a friend. When this war comes to an end, will you herd me in a Jim Crow car like cattle? Or will you stand up like a man at home and take your stand for democracy? That's all I ask of you. When we lay the guns away to celebrate our victory day, will V-Day be me day too? That's what I want to know.
Now, as you know, I focused more on Mary Lou Williams for the sake of the music. Right. But could you tell us a little bit about what you've discovered about Ann Petrie and Pearl Primus?
Yeah. So Pearl Primus was the discovery to me. I knew who she was, but I knew less about her than I knew about the others. And I absolutely fell in love with her. She was a dancer and a choreographer, well known for these extraordinary leaps that she would make, leaps of 5 feet in the air, because she also was a college athlete as well in the long jump, and she was really quite extraordinary. And she choreographed a number of dances that were set to, some of them were kind of thematically borrowing from her understanding of African dance, and she's from Trinidad originally, so she has a strong knowledge of Caribbean dance, black social dances like the Lindy Hop, but also she choreographed dances to songs like Strange Fruit and to a song called Jim Crow Car, which were dances of social protest.
Thank you. hear that train whistle blow? Can't you hear that train whistle blow? Lord, I wish that train wasn't Jim Crow. The trains, I can ride this train. Stop Jim Crow so I can ride this train. Stop Jim Crow so I can ride this train. Black and white folks riding side by side. Hear that train whistle blow? Can't you hear that train whistle blow? Can't you hear that train whistle blow? Oh Lord, this train is Jim Crow.
So there's a combination in her choreography of kind of modernist choreography, dances of social protest, and also dances inspired by Africa and the Caribbean. And she's bringing these dances along to the New York stage, in some instances for the first time. I mean, I think her contemporary is Catherine Dunham, who's also introducing this kind of dance vocabulary. And Anne Petrie was a writer from New England originally who moved to New York in 1938 with her husband, and she starts working for the Amsterdam News and eventually for a paper called The People's Voice. But while writing as a journalist, she's trying her hands as a fiction writer, and she's writing these really interesting stories. And in 1946, she publishes a novel titled The Street, which becomes the first novel by a black woman to sell over 1 million copies. And she acquires a degree of literary celebrity, unlike just about anyone else. Maybe Hurston had it before she did, but very few black women had that in the 40s. And then, of course, there's Mary Lou, who, of the three women, I sort of start each chapter in the book with 1943 because something really important happens to them in 43. But by 43, Mary Lou Williams is already famous. She's already a celebrity. She's beloved. She's well known as an arranger and a composer. And so what happens for her is that she settles in New York and she starts working at Cafe Society.
listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Trace Jones. And you are listening to a discussion between myself, me, and Dr. Farah Jasmine Griffin, an associate professor of comparative literature. Okay, what is that title exactly? Yeah, Comparative Literature and African American Studies at Columbia University. And we're discussing her book, Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists and Progressive Politics During World War II. And I thought I'd try to break in here and let you know what you're listening to thus far, or what you have been listening to. You're listening to the big hit, Scratching the Gravel. It's Mary Lou Williams. And this I got, I'm actually playing a lot of these from a few compilations. And this one is from Mary Lou Williams, 1930-1941. It's actually Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy. Ooh, and these are quick songs, so I need to be quicker. Mary Lou Williams Blues before that, there was actually six men and a girl. And, I think I'm losing my time. I'll come back to you at top of the hour. We'll try it then. Stay tuned.
But she is far better known than the other two women during the period about which I write.
And I noticed that her level of politics, Mary Lou Williams' level of politics, is probably not as, it doesn't have a name. Like Ann Petrie was technically a communist.
Well, Petrie was not. Primus was in the Communist Party. She later leaves the party. And Ann Petrie is involved in what we recognize as activist activity. She's not a communist, but she is involved in all kinds of different forms of activism, protest politics, organizing. She's doing all of that. And Mary Lou is not. I think Mary Lou is, you know, she certainly supports political candidate. She plays at a benefit for Ben Davis and a number of other candidates.
Who's a communist who is running for city council.
Right. And he wins. He becomes city councilman from Harlem. She supports him. She plays at a number of benefits, you know, for all different kinds of political efforts. But I think that she is more driven by just a kind of innate sense of not whether or not the politics of something is right, but what she thinks is right or wrong. And I think that she's already got this very giving and generous and philanthropic spirit about her. And it just so happens that in our country, we associate people who are concerned about the poor, which she is always concerned about the poor, that that's a leftist politics. That's not a centrist politics in the United States. So I don't know that she would have seen herself or named herself as a leftist. Her primary concern was always people who were poor and struggling.
Pearl Primus, mm-hmm. who was actively communist, right. Did that affect her in any way?
So what happens is, I think that the political landscape was a little bit different early on, in that people were much more open and explicit about their communist sympathies, and the Communist Party was of the, you know, certainly more so than the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, talking about issues that were of significance to poor people, to different ethnicities, particularly black people. And so there was a much broader continuum. By the end of the decade, we get the rise of McCarthyism, you know, the kind of anti-communist fervor that will take over. And Pearl especially becomes, you know, she's under surveillance. She's got a thick FBI record. They start following her as early as 1944. They take away her passport. So she pays a price for a formal connection and also a much more kind of explicit ability to articulate her politics. Petrie and Williams less so, because they aren't engaged in the Communist Party, but the ways that they suffer is that they watch people around them. For Petrie, it's the people around her, her colleagues, who begin to be blacklisted, and the venues that would have supported them, like Cafe Society, that is also under surveillance and has to close. And so if they don't experience it personally, it still has an impact on them, the kind of, you know, conservative turn that things take at the end of the decade.
Harlem. Now, you mentioned, you know, George Wolfe's production, Harlem Song, being an inspiration for this locale. Did they come together in Harlem?
Yeah, so Harlem is fascinating. The three women, at some point, all of them lived there. Primus very briefly and in what we call, what later called El Barrio, in East Harlem, and she dances at the Savoy, you know, as a teenager. Mary Lou Williams lives on Hamilton Terrace for years, and Ann Petrie lives in Harlem during this period before she moves to the Bronx, and then she moves back to Connecticut. So they're all living in Harlem or working in Harlem or walking the streets of Harlem. And I also found Harlem itself is always fascinating. So we get a lot of attention given to Harlem in the 1920s, the Harlem of the Harlem Renaissance. And then there's this sense that there's the Harlem Renaissance and then there's gentrification and that's it. But there's this really fertile period in between, and that there are always these predictions that Harlem is dying, and then it proves that it isn't dying. And in the 1940s, you not only have the three women about whom I write, but a young Malcolm X is walking the streets of Harlem, and the beboppers Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk are in Harlem.
And they're also in Mary Lou Williams' house.
Mary Williams' apartment, right? And so there's a lot of activity, political and cultural activity, happening in Harlem at Dinah Washington. I mean, you know, all kinds of interesting things. On the political side, Ella Baker is in Harlem. So it really is this kind of vibrant, exciting place where these people live and work and create a space that's conducive to the work that they're putting out in the world.
There was one thing I thought that was really fascinating about Mary Lou Williams, in that in her circle, a lot of the musicians were addicted to heroin. And her place, aside from being the place where everyone met and talked about the music and tried out their experiments musically, they also dried out.
Yeah, she ran a kind of one-woman rehab center. And she had this, which I think was actually a brilliant idea for treatment, that music, first of all, Mary Lou believed that music was healing, but she also believed that music gave a kind of discipline that one needed as one was withdrawing from drugs. And so she was providing a kind of jazz therapy. And so she would go get folk and bring them to her apartment and have them kick cold turkey while she fed them and took care of them. She also would go to their homes and clean, and I mean, she was doing all this herself. She wasn't just paying people to do it. So yeah, that apartment, I think, was a place of creativity and a place of healing for a lot of people.
Did the other two practice in the same way?
Not that I can tell. It seems like Ann Petrie was actually a very private, throughout all of her career, she was a very private person. She had good friends, but she didn't seem to be engaged in the same kind of community the way that Mary Lou was. Pearl Primus had her own community, a community primarily of dancers and drummers, and some of them were around kind of these sort of dances, art as social protests, and others of them were kind of around a burgeoning African culture, African dance community. She would eventually move out to Bed-Stuy also, and there's a strong community of people there. So she's involved in her own community, but I don't sense that either of them are as personally engaged in other people's lives and healing in the way that Mary Lou was. Hazel Scott, who was a very good friend of Mary Lou's, would call Mary Lou Saint Mary Lou. And I think there's really something about that. You know, not that she was perfect by any means, she wasn't, but just a sense of, a kind of spiritual sense of wanting to do the right thing for people is what she did. Yeah. Thank you.
To sacrifice one of these songs. This is Mary Lou Williams' solo piano over Mary's Boogie. And all of these compositions are written by Mary Lou Williams, except for one tonight. Everything else is written by Mary Lou Williams. Before that, we heard Satchel Mouth Baby. And before that, we heard Roll'em. Let's see. Before that, we heard... Oh, yeah, all of these are from the, what is it called? The ASCH recordings, A-S-C-H recordings, 1944-1947. And let's see, before that, we heard from the Zodiac Suite. It's actually mentioned in Dr. Griffin's book, Harlem Nocturne, the Harlem Suite by Mary Lou Williams. Let's see, we played... What we play... Sagittarius, to all the Sagittariuses, happy birthday. Before that, we heard Libra, and those were solo piano pieces. This was this is released on Smithsonian Folkways. It's a 1975 1975 reissue Smithsonian Folkways reissue. And originally released in 1945 on Ash Records. And before that... Uh-oh, there she is. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a good one. This one I played from Keystone Corner. Round Midnight, the only other... the second song that is not written by Mary Lou Williams, but this is Mary Lou Williams from Keystone Corner. Live at the Keystone Corner. This was my break to where I could let you know what you've been hearing. I built it in. Round Midnight. The Keystone Corner release was recorded live in 1977. The live performance producer, Todd Barkin. Hi, Todd. And let's see, before the Zodiac Suite, actually, I think I was still talking about one of the Zodiac Suite pieces, Gemini. That was the bouncy one. It includes Al Lucas on bass and Jack the Bear Parker on drums. And let's see, before that we heard... Right, computer, be nice. Before that, we heard Scratchin' the Gravel. Mary Lou Williams, also from the compilation Mary Lou Williams 1930-1941, featuring Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy. See, before that, we heard... Come on. Work with me now. Come on, you can do it. Yeah, like I said, all of these recordings are composed by Mary Lou Williams. Oh, no. Now I've got my computer's in shock. But yeah, so coming up next, after I, hopefully after I'm able to continue reading, thank goodness, we'll be hearing Hank Williams with On the Bandstand. Let's see, where was I? Losing my eyesight. Mary Lou Williams Blues, that was Six Men and a Girl. And Mary Lou Williams was the leader on that release. Yeah, can you, such is that time, I guess. And before that, we heard Jim Crow Train. That was Josh White. And that was a song that Pearl Primus used in her performance piece titled Jim Crow Car. But that was Jim Crow Train. Thank you, Dr. Farrah Jasmine Griffin, for helping me get my hands on that song so I can include it tonight. Before that, we heard Will V-Day Be Me Day Too? That was written by Langston Hughes. And I just found it on YouTube. We are going to supply it on sugarinmybowl.org on the website. Because there are two stanzas that are missing, but you didn't miss it, did you? But they're there and they're important. So we have the poem itself and we have the video, so you can watch it there. And thank you, Wali Muhammad, whoever you are. Thank you for putting it up on YouTube. And let's see. Before that, we heard Mary's Special, and that's from the chronological Mary Lou Williams, 1927 through 1940. Before that, we heard Steppin' Pretty from the Mary Lou Williams 1930-1941 compilation. We heard Mary's Idea, which is the song that was used on the promo. And we opened the show with Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972, released on RCA BMG Records. And it was originally released in 1967. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl. And as I mentioned, after we hear this selection, we'll be hearing On the Bandstand with Hank Williams. And continue to listen to Sugar in My Bowl and WBAI. And hopefully you'll continue to enjoy and be enlightened. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for December 1st. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. We start this week's listings with tonight's guest, Dr. Farah Jasmine Griffin, who appears as part of a reflection on the 50th anniversary of Amiri Baraka's Blues People book in a free event at the Newark Museum. Amiri Baraka and Professors Guthrie Ramsey and Robert O'Mealy are also on the panel. See the Rutgers Newark College of Arts and Sciences website at ncas.rutgers.edu for more info. Again, that's ncas.rutgers.edu. The musical Lady Day continues its run at the Little Schubert Theater on West 42nd Street with vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater starring as Billie Holiday. Go to LadyDayTheMusical.com for info and tickets. Pianist Mark Carey and his Focus Trio have one night at the Jazz Standard on Wednesday, December 4th. Go to jazzstandard.net for details. Organist Akiko Tsuruga has three shows this week. On Wednesday, December 4th, she'll be at Anbil Bakht Cafe on West 238th Street in the Bronx with her octet. On Friday the 6th, she's at Honeycomb Playhouse Speakeasy at 735A St. Nicholas Avenue, which is at 147th Street in Manhattan. And you can catch her Saturday night at Showman's on West 125th Street. Go to see her website for details on all of the shows at akikotsuruga.com. That's akikotsuruga.com. Or you can just go to our website and get the link. Also, drummer Bobby Sanabria has a free show at Brooklyn Academy of Music's BAM Cafe on the 6th. Saxophonist Kenny Garrett will be at the Iridium on Friday, December 6th. See theiridium.com for details on that show. Looking further ahead, pianist Harold Mayburn appears at the Jazz Standard as part of saxophonist George Coleman's new octet from December 11th to 15th. Again, jazzstandard.net has your info. Drummer Will Calhoun plays the Brooklyn Academy of Music's BAM Cafe on December 13th. Details on this show are at bam.org. That's BAM.org. Drummer Michael Carvin will be at the Kitano Jazz Club on December 13th and 14th. Go to kitano.com for info. That's kitano.com for information. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click on the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give to, the number 2, WBAI.org, where you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. Thanks to our newly expanded schedule, I'll see you next Sunday, December 8th, on the Bandstand.
Thank you, Hank Williams. Thank you again for all of those listings. I can't help it. Neither Hank nor I will be able to catch Dr. Griffin and all of our other Sugar guests at the Blues People event. But stay tuned.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
Since I focus so much on Mary Lou, it was difficult for me to expand to the other artists that you covered. So I'm sort of like trying to pry a little more out of you. And persons should just get their own copy of Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists of Progressive Politics During World War II by our guest, Farah Jasmine Griffin. Pearl Primus was a member of the Communist Party, and Anne Petrie was sort of what, a Democrat?
So, well, she's actually very interesting. She's actually a lifelong Republican. And partly that's because, although she voted for Democratic presidential candidates, Ann Petrie comes from like three or four generations of black Yankees, New Englanders. The Republican Party, as far as many black people were concerned, until Roosevelt, actually, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. They were the anti-slavery party. They were the Union Party. And so she was one of those black people, right, especially as a New Englander. And she could not reconcile, even after Roosevelt, for whom she voted, the fact that the Democratic Party could house the Dixiecrats. And so she wasn't going to be a member of a party that also welcomed the Dixiecrats. So she, even after she moved back to Connecticut, she would eventually run for public office as a member of the school board, and she would run on the Republican ticket. But her politics, now that's her party membership.
Right.
Her politics were always left-leaning, leftist. She was not a communist. She believed in private property. She says that, you know, women and black people, having been property for so long, should own their own. For her, it was the only sense of having power. But she did have a critique of the excesses of capital, and being a Republican didn't stand in the way of that. And as late as the 1980s, she was also privately voicing the fact that she was pro-choice. So she wasn't in any of the things that we associate with the contemporary Republican Party. She had progressive politics. Her party affiliation was Republican.
So wait a minute. Did she vote for Nixon?
No, she voted for all the presidential candidates. She voted for Democratic presidential candidates. Her daughter thinks she may have voted for Eisenhower, who would not be elected as a Republican today, but she voted for Democratic presidential candidates.
Now wake up, all America. The task is at our door. We should be glad that we Americans, something worthwhile fighting for. Every man must be a man, man, as we were back in 76. And every hand must be a willing hand to make the tank, plane, gun, build the ship. We're at the crossroads to our destiny. We'll have nothing else but victory. Like the rock of Gibraltar, we know we won't falter. It's our land and it's grand. We've got the breath and land. Let's show our mighty strength. And every man in this land. Now every man. Like we were back in 76. And every hand must be a willing hand to make the plane, tame the gun, and build the ship. We're at the crossroads to our destiny. We'll have nothing else but victory. Like we rocked to Gibraltar, we know we won't falter. It's our land. We've got the breath and man. Let's show our mighty strength in every man.
it for you doing the research for this? Because I remember little moments when you're on Facebook, so, and you're on my Facebook list. Yeah. But I remember moments when you had taken pictures from having visited Mary Lou Williams' house. What was it like collecting the information for this?
Yeah, so there's the practical, which was just going to the archives. These women, what I love about all three of them is that they all had this extraordinary sense of their own importance. And so they, even if the world wasn't ready to recognize them, they knew that they had something to offer, and they kept their archives. I mean, they kept things that were important. And so unlike research on a number of black women where you don't have an archive, for each of these women, you can go to a specific library and find what they chose to leave behind. So there was the archival research. I also did some interviews, not a lot, but some interviews with people who knew them and worked with them. And then when I would post those pictures, like Mary Lou Williams' apartment, it was part of the research, but was also just part of getting myself. I wanted to walk the streets they walked. I wanted to see if the same places were still there. Sometimes they weren't. You know, I wanted to stand outside of the buildings where they lived, and so I could get a sense of, if she lived here and she worked here, how might she have gotten to work? Did she walk? Oh, she could have taken the subway, or maybe she did this or whatever. What might she have seen along the way? And so I just wanted to retrace their steps. And to the extent that things were still the same, I tried to document those just so I'd have it in my head while I was writing about them. It made them seem more real to me. Yeah.
Yeah, that was actually a side benefit of Facebook. Oh, I can watch someone's process in writing a book.
Right. There were those days, and I'm like, I'm reaching. It's not coming. I'm trying. These ladies are not talking to me today, you know. Yeah.
Now, you had mentioned talking to Petrie's daughter? Or?
Yeah. So Ann Petrie had one daughter, Elizabeth, who's a writer herself, and she's written two beautiful books. One is a collection of letters from not her mother's generation, but her grandmother's generation of siblings. They're all interesting. So they're based in Connecticut, but some of them are in Hampton. Some of them go off to Hawaii. Some of them work at Tuskegee with Booker T. Washington. They're all over. And so she did a collection of their letters, and then she wrote a book about her mother, about being the daughter of this mother who was a writer, and she was incredibly generous with me, sharing material, answering questions, and just a very good source of information. And of the three women, I actually knew Petrie. I met Primus once, but I knew Petrie, and I never got to meet or hear Mary Lou in person, so that's a loss. Yeah.
So in meeting Ann Petrie, what did that do for you and your writing?
You know, I wasn't trying to be, I mean, at that time I was a graduate student, and I was, you know, trying to become a scholar. And I knew that she did not like literary criticism. She didn't like it. She thought that readers should just encounter the text by themselves. But she was quite lovely. I mean, she was still even more so very private. She left New York to escape celebrity. She didn't like celebrity. So she was very private, but she was quite generous and giving. And I remember she invited me and the writer Michelle Clift to her home for tea. And I loved watching her with her husband. It was really a beautiful relationship. And she was just very encouraging. You know, even though she wasn't crazy about literary critics, she was very encouraging of my work, and at the time I was trying to do some work on her. I think I just felt, even then, I knew that it was such a blessing to meet someone like her and to actually meet the person whose work had been important and influential. And I do think it shaped my work in terms of the fact that she was writing novels that took seriously the experience of working class black people, and that their lives were interesting and important and heroic. And I hope that my scholarship does the same thing.
And Pearl Primus, were you able to talk to someone who encountered her?
Yeah, I talked to, she has a lovely niece, Andara, who performs even now. And so I did talk to Andara about, less so about being Pearl Primus's niece, but just about dance, and developed a friendship with her. And then I did talk to some people over the years who had danced with her. I never talked to anyone who had danced with her during the period about which I was writing, but people who had danced with her later on. So I'd get a feel for her process and for her pedagogy, and someone would say, well, she would do this when she walked into the studio. So I'd get a feel for that, but it wasn't really kind of getting to know what she was like in the 1940s.
Thank you.
You had mentioned Lena Horne and Hazel Scott and just musically, you know, and you focused on Mary Lou Williams in particular in this book.
Right.
Were there more women that you could have focused on?
Yeah, there were plenty more women that I could have focused on. And I think I chose these three because I thought maybe they were less well known outside of the specific circles. Like people who know jazz know Mary Lou, but the broader world doesn't know Mary Lou. And the same was true for the other two women. So I thought it would be great to be able to introduce them. But, you know, Dinah Washington emerges at this time, and Billie Holiday's still performing, and Hazel Scott is a star at this time. Lena Horne is becoming a star. So there were so many women, and then in the literary arts, not so much in New York, but someone like a Gwendolyn Brooks is coming out. And like I said, Katherine Dunham is dancing. One of the things that I was so excited about the period is how many black women were active artists who were actually getting quite a bit of attention for the work that they were doing. It's a very fertile period to study black women. Yeah.
And it seems as though, well, the musicians anyway were political.
For the most part, I mean, certainly Hazel Scott was, without question, very outspokenly so. And Lena Horne, too, you know, Lena Horne becomes sort of, she's, the NAACP takes up her career and her Hollywood musical career, and her grandmother had been an active member of the NAACP. Hazel Scott marries Adam Clayton Powell, and even before then, you know, they're both protesting against performing in segregated places. I mean, there's a beautiful story about Lena Horne. She's supposed to sing for enlisted men, and when they bring her out, she realizes that the audience is segregated and that the German prisoners of war are seated up front with the white soldiers, and the black soldiers are in the back. So she has to decide what she's going to do, and what she does is she comes off stage, she walks down the aisle, she turns her back to the white officers, and she sings directly to the black soldiers. And I think that's one of the reasons that they love her so much. You know, she's the pinup girl for them, and they name a gun after her.
Now that's love.
That's love, right? Yeah, so this is one of those big, almost like cannon-like guns that they name after her.
Thank you.
And there's a picture of her in one of the airplanes with the Tuskegee Airmen. You know, so I think that they realize, all of them realize that they have a platform and that they have a visibility and they feel committed to do something with that visibility. So they're all race women in really interesting ways.
With regard to Pearl Primus, in what way was she a race woman?
Well, I mean, I think because she always talked about wanting to show the dignity of black people and the dignity of black people's traditions on stage. And so for her, black people wasn't just black people in the United States. It was people in the Caribbean and people in Africa. Even before she ever goes to Africa, her first trip to Africa is until 49. But before then, she's studying tradition. She's studying the art forms. She comes from Trinidad. Her grandfather had been a drummer in Carnival. She came from a family of Garveyites. So her class politics are very closely associated with her race politics. And so I think she sees herself as presenting the deep dignity of black diasporic traditions on stage. So, yeah, I would count her as a race woman, too.
Yeah. Was there a class issue with Ann Petrie?
I think it's fascinating. Ann Petrie was basically middle class. I mean, she grew up in a family. Her family owned a pharmacy. She went to pharmaceutical school. She was trained as a pharmacist. Her aunt is the first black woman to receive a degree in pharmacology. She comes from a second generation of college-educated black people. So she is not of the upper echelon of the black elite, but she's certainly of the black middle class. But she, her stories, her work focuses on the black poor and the black working class primarily. In all of her stories, her male and female characters are working class characters who are struggling. And she always said that the middle class status of her family didn't mean anything. Financially, it wasn't as solid as it was for a white middle class family. And she said that, you know, she experienced racism. And so I don't think she made those kinds of distinctions in her own mind. And like in the 20s, you have writers who want to only write about the best of the race, the most elite of the race.
The talented 10.
The 10th, right. And that's not what she's interested in doing at all. Yeah, so her, you know, the character in the street is a working class, single black mother struggling to make ends meet. And I think it's one of the first times we see that in American literature.
I also got the impression that Mary Lou Williams was probably the only one that came from a real struggling.
Yeah. So of the three, so definitely Mary Lou Williams is the only one who actually came from a family of struggling people, you know, struggling to make ends meet. Her grandmother and her mother in Atlanta had been laundresses. She was the only one of the three who did not go to college. She was probably the most innately brilliant of the three of them. You know, she was the child prodigy, but her education was on the road. I mean, she's on the road from the time she's like a preteen. And so I think part of her commitment to poor people is because she comes from poor people. But yeah, so the class difference there would be that the other two come from more solidly working class, middle class families than her family.
Unfortunately, they all care about the people. So.
All of them. Every single one of them. Women of the people. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So, Dr. Griffin, is there anything else you think we should know about Harlem Nocturne?
One final thing I'll say that one of the joys of writing this book was that even though they fall off of the radar of like mainstream audiences, all three of these women, by the end of their lives, part of the story that I love, all three of them, they're not kind of dying in obscurity and poverty. They are recognized for their work. Younger generations recognize them, honor them, and they acquire a sort of status as a kind of grand dame in their respective areas that was just nice to see. So that's one of the things I'd like to leave everyone with.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Farah Jasmine Griffin, for being with Sugar in My Bowl again.
Always a pleasure. I look forward to it all the time. Thank you for all you do, Joyce.
Thank you.
I hate to do this, but I'm going to do it now. Sorry, people. What you're listening to right now is... Basic Chords, Bop Changes on the Blues. Oh, from Embraced, Mary Lou Williams and Cecil Taylor. Yeah, Bob Cranshaw on bass and Mickey Roker on drums. Before that, we heard Pisces from the Zodiac Suite. That's probably my favorite song from there. I'm not a Pisces, but hey, I love that song. Stormy Weather before that from Mary Lou Williams live at the Keystone Corner. Mary Lou Williams on on piano, Larry Gates on bass, Eddie Marshall on drums, and that's a 2002 High Note Records release, originally recorded in 1977. Okay, now I don't know how to pronounce this, but it will be up on the Sugar site tomorrow. At least, it's Gojon Millie Jam Session from Mary Lou Williams and as part of the Ash Recordings, 1944-1947. A lot of the recordings and the second hour come from that compilation. That is one tight conversation. Yeah, before that, we heard Song of My Soul, also from that compilation. Whistle Blues. Yeah, do you remember all that whistling? That's what that was. Whistle Blues, also from that compilation. The Minutemen with Josh White on lead vocals, talking about the importance of fighting for a country. Before that, we heard Mary's Boogie, and before that, we heard Satchel Mouth Baby, I think I mentioned that, and Roll 'Em. And stay tuned for a couple of more tunes, and then we'll be hearing from La Nueva Alternativa. Okay, enough for me, Mary Lou and Cecil Taylor. Thank you.
with both the Father and the Son. Shed forth thy grace within our breast, and dwell with us, a ready gift. By every power, by heart and tongue, by act and deed, thy praise be sung. Inflamed with perfect love, each sense, that other souls may kindle hence. In this most gracious Father here, through Christ thy equal Son, our prayer, who with the Holy Ghost and thee, doth live and reign eternally.
I hope everybody's clapping their hands after having heard this program and heard Dr. Farrah Jasmine Griffin, the author of Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists of Progressive Politics During World War II. And on the subject of progressive politics, let us remember Rosa Parks did her sitting thing, the organized sitting thing. A lot of people like to say that that wasn't organized, that she was just tired, and they need to stop that myth. Anyway.
All you shining stars!
Yeah. So, we'll be back next week. Oh, let me tell you what else we heard. The La Nueva Alternativa people are standing at the door, waiting. Let's see, before this we heard, oh my goodness, Gloria. Gloria, both Gloria and Ode to St. Cecile are from Free Spirit. That's a 1987 Steeplechase release. It's Mickey Roker on drums and Buster Williams on bass, the Mary Lou Williams trio. Before that, we heard Mary Lou Williams and Cecil Taylor from Embraced. Basic chords, bop changes of the blues. So let's continue to praise the Lord. That's what this is.
For he commanded.
I don't even think I said it. It is from one of the another later effort from Mary Lou Williams. Mary Lou Williams presents Black Christ of the Andes. And that's Larry Gales on bass, Grant Green on guitar, Percy Bryce on drums, Bud Johnson on tenor saxophone, Jimmy Mitchell, solo vocalist, and the George Gordon Singers. This is a... oh, what is it, a 1975 release? Am I looking at the right thing? Oh, here it is, yeah. It's a 1975 release, originally released in... It will be right on the website. Oh, yeah, it's a 2004 release. And it was originally released in... sometime in the 70s. I lost my booklet. But like I said, it will be correct on sugarandmybowl.org. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned once again for La Nueva Alternativa. Thank you, Pastor, Reverend, Peter O'Brien, for putting all this music together and for being so cool. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Of the earth and all people, the princes and all the judges of the earth, young men too, maidens, old men and boys, praise the name of the Lord.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.